Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japan Needs. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my co-guests. My guest today is Yudai Kanayama, who is the owner of the izakaya, casual Japanese restaurant in East Village in New York City, and the creative director of Sunrise at the Canal Street Market in Chinatown, which offers bento boxes, Japanese curry rice, and pour-over miso soup in a cup. Both eateries became very successful and have a loyal fan base. And he also has a Japanese-style sandwich shop called Sandos. And there are so many Japanese restaurants outside of Japan, but it's not easy to find ones that exemplify the essence of Japanese restaurant culture. And Yudai is trying to communicate the unique Japanese tradition that is yet to be known outside of Japan. So today, we'll discuss how Yudai switched his career from fashion to food and became a restaurateur, and how he communicates Japanese tradition in New York City through his restaurants and his new sake bar opening soon. But quickly, before we start, Japan Needs is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Needs. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know, and you can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. And I have an announcement. On Wednesday, October 10th, there will be a special event called New York Chefs Celebrate Japan. It's a benefit for the Gohan Society. The Gohan Society is a 501c3 non-profit organization which aims to foster an understanding of Japanese culinary heritage in the United States through various meaningful activities, including American Chef's Training Program in Japan. And at this special event, it's a dinner event, and 27 chefs from New York City's best restaurants will cook dinner for you, including Gramercy Tavern, Daniel, Nobu, Morimoto, Boulay at Home, Contra, and many others, including the Michelin two-star Zenia of Kanazawa of Japan. And the culinary expert and the television personality, Andrew Zimmern, will be in attendance and auctioning off an amazing prize, which is dinner for 14, prepared by Andrew himself, Chef Michael Anthony of Gramercy Tavern and Untitled, and Chef Gavin Kaysen of Minneapolis Restaurant, Spoon and Stable in the winner's home. So for tickets, please go to gohansociety.org, Gohan Events. It's gohansociety.org/gohan-events. And finally, I will be moderating an event at the Japan Society in New York City on Wednesday, October 24th at 6:30 p.m. And the theme of the event is a crafting beer, traditional techniques, modern brews. And Joshua Bernstein, he's a beer journalist and author of Homebrew World, discover the secrets of both leading homebrewers. He will trace how Japanese sake techniques and the producers are influencing traditional global craft beer trends. And the talk and discussion will be followed by a tasting of Japanese craft beers and the beers influenced by Japan. For tickets, go to japansociety.org. That is japansociety.org. So now let's start a conversation with Yudai Kanehama. Hello, Yudai. Welcome to Japanese.
Hi. Thank you for having me here today. Okay. It's my honor to be here, especially after listening to the heroes in the industry. I'm neither a chef nor the sommelier, but I just do what I like to do. I just do what I love and with the passion. And I'm excited to share what I have done and what I will do in the future.
Right. Well, that's the whole point of having you here, and I'm so excited to have you. So let's talk about your background first. So where are you from, and what did you eat when you grew up?
I'm from Sapporo, Hokkaido, Japan. I was there only till when I was 18 years old. Mm-hmm. So I really didn't go to fancy restaurants. But I was just eating a lot of fresh fish. Hokkaido is known for one of the freshest fishes in Japan. And I just go to the ocean and talk to the fishermen after coming back, catching a lot of fishes with my dad. In the morning, I just go there and then they just show what they got. They just say, this is what we got. We got a lot of fishes today. Why don't you take some?
So
that's how I got to eat a lot of fresh fish for like almost nothing, no money.
But that's what fancy restaurant chefs do. So without going to the restaurant, you have that. So when and why did you come to New York?
I came here in 2009 as a college student. It's not really here. It's upstate New York. I went to university there and study fashion, which was my passion back then. I mean, it's still my thing, and I still do that too.
Mm.
But I really loved the countryside of New York, and I enjoy the nature, and I still go there on the weekends. I need it sometimes, when I'm in New York City for a while, I still need to go to enjoy the nature. And I really loved restaurants on the main street of the college town that I went to.
Mm. You went to SUNY.
Yeah, right? SUNY. Yeah, Oneonta is like 5 hours away from here. But I may be the only one still going back to that town. But I really loved it. And I studied there for 3 years, finished 4 years college in 3 years. And I had another extra year to do another study at FIT. So I transferred to FIT in 2012 and finished their 1 year program there too.
That's amazing that, you just said you didn't go outside of Hokkaido before 18, but you have amazing English skills, and also you skipped the grade and then went to FIT. So that's very impressive.
I just wanted to do as many things as I could do. So I was taking a lot of classes in a semester, and I'm happy that I could study at FIT at the end. I mean, I think staying in the nature is good, but then at the same time, I still needed the experience in the city too.
Right. And so what was special about fashion to you?
Well, I think I've always liked the fashion since I was young, growing up with my grandmother, who's very, very fashionable, wearing all these crazy stuff every day. And I grew up with her all the time. And I even chose the high school with no school uniform just because I didn't want to wear the school uniform and look like the same people as other people.
Mm.
So, I chose the no school uniform school, and I was even trying hard to not to wear the same clothes like every single day. That's why I was working. I started arubaito, the part-time job, for the first time in my life, just to buy the clothing, and then I spent all of my money there. So,
oh wow. Whenever I see you, you stand out in the crowd because your clothes is so personal, and there's always something cool about it, so that makes sense. So after graduating from FIT, you worked for a clothing company in New York. So what kind of job was it, and what did you do? What did you learn from it?
Okay, I worked at a Japanese retailer called 45 RPM. 45 produces like the most, the highest quality Japanese denim made in Okayama Prefecture.
Mm.
And it is really expensive. Like it's over $1,000 a pair of denim. So I was a sales associate at the store. I started as a sales person. And I was, you know, talking to the customers, explaining why it's over $1,000. You know, sometimes it took me like an hour to explain what it is. I mean, in order to sell that kind of expensive thing, you have to talk about everything, not just what it is, but about like a background, how it's made and stuff like that. So it was just, like natural for me to talk about things for a long time. It doesn't matter if it's expensive or not. That's who I am now, I think. That's what I learned. To sell things, you have to really explain with fun stories, maybe.
Mm. Yeah. Well, in other words, though, you have to believe in the value of that $1,500 jeans or something, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't sell anything I don't like. I think it's really coming out from my passion and love of what I sell, what I do. So I think it's really important to love what you do.
Right. Yeah. So that's what I think it's uber in your life. I think that's the impression that your kind of consistency and you believe, strong belief in something. That's, I think, what you do. All right. So we're going to talk about it more through your restaurant experience. But why did you decided to get into the food industry?
So I was looking for something else to do after quitting the previous job and the loom mate back
then. Wait, but you decided to quit the job?
Well, it was my first time to be in this very strict Japanese, like a traditional working environment. Although I enjoyed and I loved what I was selling, I just really couldn't adjust to that kind of environment yet. And I was in New York City, and I just thought I wanted to do something that's more maybe New York,
right.
Not too Japanese. I really felt sometimes a lot of stress, and I thought being stressed is the worst thing in life. I just want to live longer by not doing anything stressful.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Like sometimes, I think you come across people working for a Japanese company, subsidiary or something here in New York City, you really think, wow, this is as if we are in Japan. So there's a strong corporate culture.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so you opened the izakaya in 2015. So how did it happen?
So yeah, I met the roommate who was a chef and he came to me and said, when I was looking for a job, he came to me and said, Yudai, I only know how to cook. I don't know anything else, but I want to open the restaurant. And he's like, can you do everything else? And, you know, I said, I think I can do it. It's just the difference between selling clothes and food. And I feel I see the bigger potential even in food, because people need to eat to survive, but they don't really need to wear the fancy denim to survive. So that's how it started. And his friends who are our partners in izakaya, we just came together and all of us invested some money to start the izakaya.
Right. Okay. So how do you describe the essence of Japanese izakaya? Because the izakaya, you name it, the izakaya,
right?
So you wanted to express something.
Yeah. So to be honest, I came here at the age of 18, even before trying to many izakayas in Japan. I haven't tried it. When I came here, I really didn't know what it was. I really had to go back to Japan to try a lot of things before opening. And I really love the culture of sharing those small delicious plates with friends and drinks. And so I really wanted to do exactly the same way that they do in Japan. So we don't want to do sushi, because that's not what the izakaya is. Like a traditional izakaya will never do sushi. I would tell customers when they come into the restaurant and ask me if we have sushi, I said, I know a good sushi restaurant and that you should go to that kind of place. Mm-hmm. And that happened many, many times. And maybe some people would consider having sushi after seeing the potential in sushi, but then our core is to stay true to what the actual izakayas are in Japan. You know, we lost a lot of customers, but at the same time, we got a lot of people who wanted to know what the izakaya is. That's why we named our restaurant The Izakaya.
Mm.
And I'm looking forward to seeing the time that people are saying, let's go to the izakaya. And I just want to hear this, The Izakaya, and I want to see izakaya aside from the regular Japanese restaurant. I want to create this category, establish the category izakaya aside from the regular Japanese restaurant, just like sushi restaurant, ramen restaurant. Izakaya is a different category of restaurant. So, you know, The Izakaya is the name of the restaurant. At the same time, it's a category of the restaurant that I wanted to establish.
Right. So you mentioned the sharing, and I think whenever you go to Japanese traditional izakaya, there's energy, and I think service usually say, yashimase. It's like a screaming, like right. With a lot of energy, fast, and the food is reasonable, and again, shared by people. And it's almost like you are eating at somebody's house.
Right, yeah. You know, even sometimes people orders our signature, like chicken namban dish, group of four orders, four of them, I say, you cannot order four things. I want you to enjoy the variety. And that's how I'm educating them. Sometimes I think I have to say no, because that's not the way I want people to enjoy. I want people to know what the izakaya is. So if I say yes to that kind of order, that would be just a regular Japanese restaurant. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so that's like if you go to a regular American restaurant, you just pick appetizer, entree for your own, and then without sharing. Although that trend is kind of changing. But
right.
So, yeah, that's the shared spirit, casual, celebrate the occasion, the kind of festive feeling, I think, is a part of izakaya.
Yes.
Okay, so so at your restaurant, it's a great izakaya place, but I think you mentioned that you really try to educate people. Like you said, don't order chicken namban for four of them.
Yeah.
So how do you, other than that, how do you try to educate people?
Right. Well, I think it's coming from my experience selling $1,000 denim. For me, it was normal thing to do, to talk about things for in detail. Even at the restaurant, I didn't think it's a different thing. Like I said, I think it's just the difference between selling clothes or food. So the way I saw things was the same. So I was talking 1 hour about the $1,000 denim, and I was explaining about this addictive cabbage for 10 minutes, which was, for me, was just 10 minutes. Some people think it's a lot of talk just to explain what the addictive cabbage is, but I didn't even think. It's my natural behavior, and I talk about things for a long time because it seems that they didn't know what it was, and I really wanted to explain with my passion. Yeah, the foods are good. I think a lot of restaurants serve the good food. But what makes difference us from the other places is the way we communicate with the customer, the way we educate the customers. And, I mean, New York Times, that's how we got on New York Times saying on the article that they've never seen anybody explaining about this cabbage, simple cabbage dish for 10 minutes, and they really enjoy that experience. So we are trying to give the best experience that they can have.
Okay, so can you do a 30-second version of addictive cabbage? What is it?
Well, I mean, so addictive cabbage was really important for us to be famous. Well, that's addictive cabbage. Yamitsuki cabbage is the thing that most people usually order at the izakaya in Japan. I mean, when I went to izakaya in Japan, that's what everybody ordered at the beginning. So I thought something that everybody ordered has to be amazing or delicious. interesting. So we realized that we need to make the best addictive cabbage by putting a lot of effort to it. So the chef and I discussed, and we discovered this the new type of addictive cabbage that's been salted and massaged for such a long time. And we spent like a lot of time to just make addictive cabbage, which even in Japan, maybe they don't do it. They just chop the cabbage and put the salt and sesame oil. That's that's what the like actual addictive cabbage is. But then we almost pickle them. Like, we don't really pickle them, but it's been salted and massaged and washed, and it gets like a lot of, I mean, it gets amazing texture to it, and then people loved it, and we still don't compromise after like knowing that it's a lot of work, and then we have to compromise the other things sometime because of the cabbage. And then the chef come to me, say, do we need to still do this? And I say, yes, that's that we need the addictive cabbage first and other things later. But I think it's that important to do.
The consistency. And also, I think, you know, you have to be proud of what you do to talk about the product with the passion.
And the core, the concept of what I do, I mean, whatever I do, is to make the place that employees, that workers love the most. That's the first thing that I try to do before even making customer like it, because I think the vibe created from those employees who love what they're doing, it's something that's unbeatable, that which could make customer like that place. So I think first thing is to make the place that employees like, and then customer will like that kind of place. So that's why we create the menu together, all of the employees together, talk about what we can do to improve, and yeah, I want all of my employees to come to my restaurant on the day off. I think that's the most convincing thing to the customer. And this is the restaurant that even the employees go when they're not working. I think that's what I want to do. And that, yeah, a lot of things I will do, I will do the same way.
Right. Sounds like it's like a community and a place to be. So it's amazing. And I think you mentioned the chicken namban. So just for our listeners who's not familiar with chicken namban, what is chicken namban?
So it's a deep fried chicken that's dipped in like a sweet and sour soy sauce based sauce. And after that, we put the homemade tartar sauce on top. It's like a Japanese white sauce that we make, and it's the combination of those two different sauces makes it amazing.
Right, it's really classic, and sounds like you really offer very traditional menu items, but commitment, higher quality items.
Yeah, it's been on the menu since the opening, and not all the menu stays forever, but this is one of the few things that's still there, and it's still been the signature, and that everybody orders, and like the addictive cabbage.
Right, okay, and I also know that you offer curry doria.
Yes.
Yeah, what is it?
Yeah, so everybody asked me the same question, what the doria is. I don't know, I mean, the origin of the name, but doria is basically, comes with the butter rice and some kind of sauce and cheese on top. It could be any kind of combination. So curry doria, in this case, is the sauce is curry, so, and with the butter rice and cheese on top, that's why it's curry doria, and it's prepared in the oven. And we wait until the cheese get melted on the top, and it's I think it's more like a Europeanized Japanese dish that's really, really popular. A lot of people love Japanese curry, but I don't know if many people do curry doria, and doria is something that we wanted to bring in.
I think it's a relatively new invention, I think.
Right.
Yeah, it's like a very super comfort food, and it sounds weird, but it's very traditional Japanese food.
Right.
It's a yoshoku, a Western style Japanese.
Yes.
Okay. So why do you think the izakaya, became so popular?
All the essences that I've talked, so it's the restaurant that the workers love the most. it's the lesson that I love the most when customer ask me, what's your favorite restaurant? Without a doubt, I say, it's the izakaya, it's my restaurant. And that's what all of my employees do too. I think that's very convincing. And also that story about all the dishes makes people like excited. It's like I said before, no one is trying to make bad food. Everybody makes good food. If they want to open the restaurant, they should have good food. So me as a person who's coming from different field thinks the other elements than food are the really important things to consider. The way we brand the restaurant, you know, nowadays a lot of restaurants do amazing branding, and that's really important, and the social media thing. But we've never spent any money on PR, and we think ourselves could be an PR inside the restaurant by giving an amazing experience inside. That's, I think, more convincing than those PR that's brought by with the money.
Right. Sounds like you learned so much from your experience in fashion and, you know, your corporate experience with Japanese company to sell.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and I think also you told me that before, you know, the fashion on, it's the same clothes, but, you know, if you go to fashion show, you really understand there's a story behind it. Right. You'll feel like, oh, wow, this is awesome.
Yeah, and that's, I'm more interested in the story than actual products. And I think, yeah, that's why I put the focus on, emphasis on the stories behind it, the backstory,
with the value behind it.
Yes.
Right. Okay, so let's take a quick break here, and then when we come back, we'll talk about Yudai's exciting project at the new Essex Street Market. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Yudai Kanayama, who's the owner of the Izakaya, a casual Japanese restaurant in East Village, and the creative director of Sunrise at the Canal Street Market in Chinatown, which offers bento boxes, Japanese curry rice, and a pour-over miso soup in a cup. So, so as you said, you have an interesting concept summarized at the Canal Street Market since May 2017. So what is the concept of Sunrise?
So Sunrise is a company, is the name of a store that's owned by this Japanese holding company called Agri Holding. Agri Holding is a company that exports rice, Japanese rice, and introduce the beauty of Japanese rice. So Sunrise New York started as a place to introduce Japanese rice that's made in Japan. They have four or five locations in Singapore, Sunrise Singapore. They have their onigiri rice ball spots. So we started here in New York also as a onigiri shop. But just realized that we wanted to do more than just onigiri. Using Japanese rice, we could do many, many other things. So we became more like a Japanese lunch spot where you can find the freshly made bento box, not like the one that's been already made and put it in the refrigerator. We get the order and we make the bento box right there for each customers. And also we do the aside of bento, we do pour over dashi, just like we make coffee. We use the same set as when you use the when you make coffee, when you drip the coffee.
Like if you go to like Blue Bottle Coffee,
right? That's, that's exactly what we have at the station at the Kanaoshi Market, Sunrise, New York. We put the this amazing pressed vegetables and mushrooms, like and seaweed, that's invented by Atsushi Nakahigashi-kun.
He
was also in the
radio
show, I guess. Yeah.
Episode 58.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah, we use that thing and put it in the cone in the filter with the extra bonito flake, and pour the hot water filter through. And then you get amazing dashi inside the cup. And the cup has the miso of your choice. You can choose like a dark red miso or the yellow or whatever, awase miso. So we let them choose, the customer choose the miso, and then we make the miso soup in front of each customer. So that's, I think if you think about it, like even the fancy, expensive Japanese restaurants don't make the miso soup light. It's maybe some miso soup was already made and then they serve it to the customers. I think it's really amazing, luxurious experience that you see how miso soup is being made. And we do it like one by one for each customers.
Including dashi.
Right.
It's fresh too.
Yes. So, and then you really smell amazing dashi flavor. We say to the customer, people think this is like a performance, but it's really not a performance. It's the way that we think. It's the best way to get the most umami out of these amazing vegetables. And it's really actually, the miso soup is actually delicious and very, very flavorful. A lot of American people, they try and they say it's the most flavorful miso soup that they've ever tried. And I think it's also interesting that we serve it in a cup. So, you know, sometime at the restaurant, at my restaurant, a lot of customers ask me if I can get the spoon to eat the miso soup. Well, that's really not the way miso soup should be eaten. I mean, in Japan, we don't even say eat the soup. We say drink the soups. I want everybody to drink it. I thought about how can I make people here drink the soup. And finally, I think we came up with this answer. By serving the cup of miso soup, they don't even need a spoon anymore. And then now they're drinking the miso soup. It's a dream came true.
Right. That's an interesting point, right? Because I was hesitate. Yeah. How shall I say eat or drink? And eat soup, drink the soup.
Yeah.
We never eat soup. So.
Right. I mean, yeah. So miso soup is not about, I don't think what's inside, but it's more about the dashi. I want people to enjoy that soup. So we don't really put anything inside. It's just the dashi and miso. It's the simplest form of miso soup. So they don't need a spoon at all. It's like, instead of coffee, maybe they could try the miso soup.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so I think it's a great idea because I think even for me, traditionally, I have to wait for dinner or breakfast, whatever it is. I have to sit at the table and drink miso soup. But this way, in a cup, I can just drink all day if I wanted to.
Right, yeah. And I'm hoping to see the line of people waiting for a cup of miso soup in the morning soon. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you know, like broth has been popular, and it's the same idea of a Western stock became broth and beef broth, whatever, like a broth by Chef Mark Kanora. I think it's a new way, instead of drinking coffee or tea, that's an interesting and nutritious way to enjoy the beverage.
And we also make ochazuke, it's like a comfort food in Japan. It's a bowl of rice and with the topping on top, and then we pour the dashi over it. So we do the same way for the ochazuke. We do hand drip the dashi and pour over this nicely decorated mountain of rice with the beautiful color topping. And yeah, with the amazing dashi on top, then that's the ochazuke that we have at the Kanoshi market. And ochazuke, I don't think it's a fancy thing. It's more like, for me, it was the leftover salmon from last night's salty, and then the next day, right, maybe I would make ochazuke with that, because it's still salty now, and then you can put it on with dashi, and then it gets it makes amazing ochazuke.
That's so really good. I look forward to it, actually.
Right. So yeah, I mean, our ochazuke looks better than I think the original ones in Japan, and it tastes good too. Sometime in a cold day, you wanna try that.
Well, I'll come and see you there soon for ochazuke too. Okay, so, and also I heard you're working on a new project, and it's with the same partner with Sunrise.
Yes.
And it's I heard a sake bar.
Yes.
So what is going on there?
So there is a very big development happening in Lower East Side of Manhattan. The Essex market has been there for a long time on the Essex Street. But then they are trying to expand it into something very huge, and they're gonna have a movie theater, and they're gonna have Bowling Lane. They're gonna have even school and medical care system as a center or something like that. And in the basement of the movie theater, they will have the food hall, like a food court. And they didn't announce the vendors yet, but I've heard from them that there's gonna be a biggest like a beer hall and a wine hall inside the market. And then we approached them and said, I think you're missing one thing. If there is a beer hall and wine hall, why don't you let us do the sake hall? Yeah, so we're trying to be just like the other beer hall and wine hall. We are trying to be kind of the biggest sake hall in the States, and that's the project happening now. And yes.
Right. Yeah, I heard. The Essex Street Market, I think its history goes back to like 1940 or something.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I heard it's going to be like 9 buildings. It's a huge complex, right? And I heard it like 40 vendors in total.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I can't wait. So do you know when it's going to happen? It's going to open?
Well, I think the early next year, 2019, maybe March, February. That's what they say in New York. Everything takes longer than expected. So
right, maybe in the summer.
Right.
Right. Okay, so what kind of concept? Like, you know, sake bar could be anything.
Yes. So whatever I do, I did in the past, and I do from now, I don't want to make it too Japanese. I mean, it is Japanese already. We have a lot of sake and with the Japanese food. But I think when I want to introduce something new to this country, it's I think important to have this environment that they are very used to. So I don't want to make it like a classic looking Japanese place, because I don't really know what they are yet. I'm still young. I'm too young to know what the classic Leo Japanese sake places are, but I know from experiencing a lot of bars in New York, and there are a lot of people drinking a lot, and I'm hoping that people drink sake just like they do at the bar they go to. So we're saying sake only bar, so it'll be like a bar, and with the good food. That's the important part, with the good food, because in New York, I finish eating at the nice restaurant, I go to a bar, and maybe I'm still hungry, and I want to eat I don't want to eat a lot, because I'm not that hungry, but I want to maybe try one or a few, two things. And there's not many places I've found yet that you can just have one drink with one good food. So that, I think, is our concept. That would be our concept. Something that you can just stop by anytime, like, without hesitation. Like, a lot of places, either it's a restaurant, then you have to go and eat a lot and spend some money, or there's a bar, a lot of bars there with just snacking out from the package, you know. So I want to be like right in the middle that people can come with. Not they don't need to order a lot, but they can just drink with a good small plates.
It's like a tsumami.
Yes, a lot of tsumami and so me and my partner didn't go back to Japan to learn to get the inspiration. We instead went to these pinchos places in Europe. Like San Sebastian was the best place to get inspiration, I think. Well, I just really loved the culture of hashigo is like a Japanese word that means going to bar after another, like one another. You go to this bar, drink one beer with one of two small things, and then you go to another one next to, right next to it, and then you have something else there, and then you go to another one. You guys, and I really love that culture, but in New York, I don't think you can do it because it's too expensive. Like I said, there's no bars with good, not many bars. I don't know if there's no, but then not too many bars like that with the good food. So I want to see, people doing hashigo here.
Right. Oh, that's interesting because almost all restaurants have, the waiting bar, bar setting, but you have to probably order appetizer and whatever. But, you know, I think one time people started to serve bar menu. I don't think it's so popular anymore.
Yeah.
So, and it's a Spanish bar culture.
I really loved it. And I didn't need to spend a lot of money after going to five different bars. I became so full after that.
And interesting. So, tsumami, that's, pick or pinch in Japanese. And I think it's not a coincidence in pinchos in Spanish it's the same meaning.
I really saw a lot of similarities between pinchos and Japanese food. I mean, there's a lot of things on the stick just looks like an yakitori. Interesting combination of two or three different fishes like sashimi, which we never would do. Like, we don't mix two sashimi together and we eat them together. That's like no way, but I think it's such a new thing and it could work as a tsumami too. I think it was a great time to see what's outside New York, and it's not here yet, so we were kind of stuck in the idea staying here in New York for a long time, and we want to do something new and something that's not here yet. So in Japanese, we didn't go to Japan. We went to somewhere else to get something interesting. Yeah.
Right. So how do you incorporate that story element? By educating sake, each sake or?
Yeah. So we're trying to get a lot of sake, hopefully the largest section of the sake in New York. I think it's very difficult to tell the difference of the sake compared to the wines or compared to the beers that taste really different depending on what kind of beer you're drinking. But the sake, very, very difficult to educate. So, of course, I need to talk about what Junmai is, what Junmai Ginjo is, what Junmai Daiginjo is. But I think more important than that, I think, is, I need to do a different approach, this original sake that's being made for us now for the sake bar, they came up with this idea of selling sake not by the taste or not by the kind of sake, but by the mood of the day. So like they're making sake for a rainy day, sake for a sunny day. I think it's such a great idea to sell that way. Especially when the audience is somebody who are not really familiar with the taste of sake. I think there are so many different ways that I could come up with, not just by the taste or by the kind of sake, but I think that's one of the ways that's to make this sake a thing that's as big as wine and beer.
Well, to be honest, personally, that only thing matters, what do I feel like drinking?
Yeah.
And today, I don't care if Daiginjo or Junmai Daiginjo. It's okay. I just want to have something that fits in today's, whatever it is.
So I asked them, how are you feeling today? And they said, I'm relaxing today. And then I have a sake for a relaxing day. And that's what they drink. And then they really, if they like it, that's good.
Right. Wow, that's exciting. I am hoping maybe you can get one thing I'm really missing here in New York. I mean, we have Brooklyn Club, and Dabutail Sake in Boston, near Boston. Yes. But I really want to taste more American-made craft sake.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I really love Brooklyn Craft, and we carry that sake in the izakaya too. Yeah, I think it's amazing. I mean, everything is made with the ingredients like locally sourced in the States. I mean, the rice, maybe some of the ingredients they get from Japan, but I think it's interesting the way they sell, the way they brand themselves, which is really different from the way I think classic sakagura in Japan do.
Mm.
And I take it as something else. I mean, it's really delicious, and I love it a lot, and I like the stories too, so that's mm-hmm. why I think I can sell this well. It's delicious at the same time, it has a story to it.
So, right. Yeah. Okay, so please keep me posted, and when it's open, maybe you can come back and talk about it.
Yes.
Okay, so you have another project, and that's called Sandoz. Mm-hmm. So what is it?
Yeah, so Sandoz started a few weeks ago. It's the newest project that we are doing. So for the lunchtime at izakaya, we invented this katsu sandwich. Beef katsu sando is kind of a thing now. It's getting super popular in New York City.
Mm.
A lot of restaurants do wagyu beef katsu sando.
So katsu means a cutlet.
Yeah, like a cutlet. Yeah, deep fried cutlet. So we thought about doing something similar to that, but we wanted to stay classic to what the katsu sando is. And then katsu sando, I think, is original version of that is always pork and beef katsu cutlet is a kind of a new thing, and I prefer to eat beef as a steak. Not, I don't usually eat the beef fried, so we wanted to make the best pork cut sandwich. We invented this slowly cooked, in low temperature cooking pork. Before frying, we cooked the pork slowly in a low temperature,
which makes like
the
hours.
Pork juice. Yeah, and it's 8 hours for pork and then 2 hours for sauce. And I don't think nobody in Japan spends as much energy as to make just the katsu sandwich.
That's nuts.
It is, like you just get the pork, cut it, and then bread it and fry it. That's the regular katsu sando. So,
that's like your addictive cabbage.
Yeah, we're calling like the best katsu sando just because of the work that we put on the amount of work we put into it is a lot. And then, I think we really believe that it's like one of the best katsu sando. I mean, for me, it's the best I've ever tried.
Mm.
So, yeah, we are at the Smorgasburg trying to reach a lot of people from all over the countries.
Mm.
So by
for
selling, yeah.
Listeners who are not familiar with the Smorgasburg, it started in 2011, and people call it the Woodstock of eating. Basically, it's at the weekend food festival with about like 70 vendors of all the food.
And really a lot of people go, and a lot of locals and tourists go to that festival to enjoy a variety of foods. And
right, but it's hard to be a vendor, and it's almost like incubator of great food businesses.
Yeah, I think it's very competitive because a lot of people want to be at the Smorgasburg, and it took us a while to get a booth there, but finally we got it a few weeks ago. We started last month, and we are selling Japanese sandwiches to just show people that Japan also offers amazing sandwiches.
Mm.
Not just, Japan is known for a rice country, but then I think we also have amazing bread and sandwiches. And so we're doing not only katsu sando, but we are also doing the fruit sandwich. That's also a big thing in Japan.
Mm.
So, we call our place Sandoz because sando is a way of calling Japanese sandwich in Japanese language.
So. Mm. Yeah, well, it's interesting because Japanese bread is fluffier and softer and square.
Yeah.
And it's a lesson, but I think, the rice has been a staple for a long time that bread tend to be more flavored in Japan. There's more butter in it, shortenings.
Yes.
And so it's a different idea of bread compared to sourdough here or French baguette.
Yeah.
In France.
Yeah, we even, like, after we built the katsu sando, we pan-fried the bread with the butter, too. So it soaks the nice taste of butter, too, inside. It's just really, for the katsu sando, it's a lot of work that we're doing. Even outside, we do the same thing. And yeah, I think it's, I'm hoping that people understand the beauty of sandwiches in Japanese. Yeah.
Right. Well, by the way, I looked up what the origin of a katsu sando. So according to what I read, it's the origin was one tonkatsu, pork katsu restaurant in Ueno, and started in 1935. Mm-hmm. And that was originally made for geisha who couldn't open mouth. Big, so small piece of sandwich.
Yeah, ours is like the thickest one that I don't think.
No forgation.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, so it's sounds very Western, but it's the traditional Japanese style. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So which smorgasbord? There are like different smorgasbord.
Yeah, Saturday in Williamsburg and Sunday in Prospect Park.
Mm.
Yeah, we are... on both days, yeah, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m.
Mm.
Yes.
Okay, so it's sandos.
Yes.
I have to look for it. Okay, so I know that you have not only restaurants, but you have many other interests in your life.
Right.
So what's your ultimate goal of doing many things?
Yeah, I'm not trying to be a person in the food industry only. I think I don't even consider myself as a restaurateur, but I'm trying to be a person who can introduce what I love with passion and love and making it popular, making it a thing here. I was in a fashion industry. I still like clothing and I still collect the vintage clothing, and it's just, I do many things, but one thing for me is just do whatever I like and then just talk with the fan stories and trying to make everything popular. Just, I'm trying to be more like an ambassador of whatever I like.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's usually Japanese thing. So, that's what I'm trying to do now.
Mm, right. Effectively, you're bridging cultures. Mm. So, okay, so what's your plan?
My plan, when I established the company for the izakaya, I named the name of company as Shiawase Factory.
Mm.
So it's a factory that Shiawase means happiness being made. So. Yeah, that's basically what I'm trying to do. I want to make many, many places that people can be happy. So it can be anything. Yeah, it doesn't have to be a restaurant. It can be anything. And I want to help a lot of people, you know, by having a lot of places we can involve more people. And yeah, we can, if something is fun and if I like that too, we can make that happen. And that's my goal to do from now. Yes.
Okay, great. So it's a happiness maker.
Yeah.
So where can we find your latest about your restaurants and other happiness production?
Well, we don't really have a website. The best way that the place that I spend my most time is at the izakaya still. So.
Okay.
Well, please come and try our food and talk to me.
Okay, yeah. Great. So that's the izakaya.com.
Right, that's the place. Yeah, and the izakaya.ny. That's the website, but we don't really use it much. So the best way is actually coming to the restaurant.
Come and eat. Share the happiness.
In person, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that's great.
Yeah.
All right, so thank you for joining us today, Udai.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. And Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And our engineer today is Matt Peterson. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.